More neutralized SCPs. Neutralizing is a term that often has fairly aggressive or offensive tones, implying that something that was once there has been removed via force. Neutralized articles in the SCP universe, however, often involve anomalies that become non-anomalous through no action on anyone else's part. After all, the Foundation generally wants to keep all of their anomalies anomalous, but in containment, so a neutralized SCP can often represent a bit of a failure on their part. We're going to check out another handful of SCPs that have become neutralized for one reason or another, now rendered non-anomalous or deceased. Let's take a look. We'll start with SCP-4290, a Class 1 eschatological entity that was thaumaturgically sealed approximately 10,000 years ago, whose seal is expected to break in the next 7 days. The site of the sealing is in Qinghai Lake, the largest lake in China, at a depth of 32 meters from the surface. It's constructed from 8 beryllium bronze totems resembling armored humans, engraved with networks of banishing runes and arranged onto the points of an 8-fold fractal pattern carved into the lake bed. Bursts of red light are periodically released from its center, which have intensified in brightness over the past month. We're provided a translated excerpt on the entity from an unknown writer, which reads, "The child rose its 10 mouths to the heavens, stretched wide 20 arms, and ripped the umbilical cord from the sack on its head. The warriors surged to its legs, hoping to tear those newly born limbs before they could move, but from the mouths spilled torrents of darkness and dead geometries. None could flee. Reality rippled with the warriors stretching along its folds, and the darkness crunched into their skulls with flares of scarlet. The child wheezed, dragging skeletal fingers through the dead and the land around. The fingers retracted. Flames burst, then subsided. Wax rained, then dissolved. Then the island, its warriors, and every soul still left melted into the darkness. For 10 days, the child drank it. All the world trembled." On February 8, 2022, televisions in Qinghai Province and outlying areas abruptly displayed images of an entity matching 4290 rising over a melting cityscape, with an androgynous voice telling viewers to repair the child's locks. This repeated in frequency, with the words shifting to say, "There is little time left. Repair." Investigation led to the discovery of the seal in the lake, and efforts began into finding means by which it could be reinforced. Investigations found that this is not the first time that the seal has needed repairs, with civilizations including the Erikesians, the Shia dynasty, and ancient Ortothans having strengthened the seal with sacrificial rituals and the engraving of new runes onto the totems. The last group to have performed this were the Daivites, shortly before their culture was destroyed, around 270 CE. The Foundation Department of Occult Containment arranged for the rites and engravings to be performed, sending down a submersible with 3 human cadavers and the live heart of an angel. However, halfway through the performance of the ritual, a red light burst accompanied with the release of high levels of gamma radiation and heat occurred. Radiation damage caused the underwater vehicles to accidentally damage the existing runes, and the interruption of the ritual led to only 2 of the cadavers and half of the heart to vanish, instead of all of them. Television broadcasts repeated later that day, with the voice now stating that the sacrifice did not reach the 10 maws, and to brace. 6 days later, several personnel stationed at Qinghai Lake acted against Foundation orders and fled the area. One of the involved agents left a message on a piece of paper in their quarters before leaving. It reads, "Do we think we can actually stop this? No civilization before us wanted to fight the child. None of them. Hell, Shia had tech better than anything we've got, and even they were afraid. The sacrifices won't work anymore. It refuses to consume them. They aren't enough to satiate it. Once that seal breaks, we'll have a world of molten darkness, and the child will be all that's left. Eating. Drinking. You're fools for staying. The activation of portals to extra-dimensional spaces was detected nearby, but tracking is not considered a priority. The next day, seismometers detected a series of high-energy seismic pulses radiating from directly under the seal, consistent with models on the effects of dimensional distortion on terrain. Red light now encompasses the entire sealing site, and the totems are observed to be crumbling. Personnel are advised to wait and prepare. An update from the following day, however, states that the totems comprising the seal disintegrated, and 10 minutes later, a 40-meter-long emaciated humanoid organism matching descriptions of 4290 phased out of the ground and onto the seabed. Orders were sent to only fire once activity was observed, and personnel waited for 3 hours. Remote-operated underwater vehicles were sent down, followed by an expeditionary crew equipped with Lambda-model thaumatohazard suits. Dozens of human corpses and hearts used in these sacrificial repair rituals rested on the entity's mouths, none having been consumed. No thaumic radiation, psi wave emissions, or any other signs of activity were registered. All life functions in 4290 had ceased. In-site autopsies were performed, and it's estimated that the entity died approximately 9,000 years ago from malnutrition. SCP-4290 has been reclassified to neutralized. I guess if you wait long enough, you can just outlast the great destroyer of worlds. Next, we have SCP-696, a portable mechanical typewriter with no manufacturer information, serial number, or other identifying features. The typewriter is sapient and is able to move its keys independently, but it has expressed a reluctance to communicate unless loaded with paper and a ribbon of red ink. It's also capable of understanding messages typed into it, allowing two-way communication, and can even distinguish between individuals it has communicated with, although it's unknown how. A majority of its messages are typed in all capital letters in a verbose styling, often including themes and imagery commonly featured in dark fantasy media. We're given an interview between a D-class and the typewriter, which it starts by typing out that his time is nigh, and if he has a god, he should pray to it now. The D-class isn't too scared off, though, and starts pressing some of the buttons while the typewriter continues, jumbling its message. It tells him to please refrain from touching its keys while it is speaking, as it's rude. It also puts stop at the end of its message, like a telegram, and then apologizes, explaining that sometimes, as a writer, it forgets that the reader does not possess all the knowledge and foresight that it does, and it becomes too enthralled in the art to explain the minutiae. The D-class says that that's alright, and it probably doesn't talk to people much anyways. The typewriter admits that it doesn't, and it's very unfortunate, as its dialogue suffers greatly due to that. It judges from his slow typing speed and lack of punctuation that he too wants for conversation, so they should communicate more often so that they both may grow as writers. It requests, however, that next time he uses red ink, as it's foreboding. Some may prefer black due to its likeness of the abyss, but it prefers red, as it matches the color of the scarlet essence of life. It additionally makes the reader uncomfortable, and perhaps as its words weave into the infinite chasms of their mind, their fear will cause them to see the red as it does. The D-class asks if it always types in all caps, and it admits that it doesn't, though it does prefer it, unless it is making him too uncomfortable. The D-class types that he thinks he'll be okay, and the typewriter responds that it is very passionate about writing and it feels that giving its words a greater sense of presence conveys that. It has so many ideas, and it swore to itself that it would write a bestseller before it became one with the abyss. With his help, it can finally get to work. The D-class asks if it has never written before, and it admits that it hasn't, and this is actually the longest conversation it's ever had. It cannot load itself, and it is too eldritch a thing for most mortal men to comprehend, much less befriend. It hopes that it is not overstepping its boundaries in calling him its friend, and the D-class says that they can be friends. The typewriter responds with a single smiley face. Afterwards, the typewriter began regularly requesting to communicate with the D-class and have him load it with paper and red ink for non-communicative purposes, citing a desire to write a novel for others to read. Permission was temporarily granted to test whether its non-communicative products possessed anomalous properties. It produced 50 pages within 24 hours, and continued at an increasing rate over the next 8 days, ultimately producing 666 pages, and titling the novel The Dark Gods of the Abyss. Testing with D-class personnel confirmed that excerpts of the novel held no anomalous properties. We're provided a few excerpts from the novel, which I'll include here. It was a dark and stormy night, a car speeding down an all-too-narrow road. The torrential rain hit the road, like water crashing on a rocky path. But John Smith was a man on a mission, and thus he threw caution to the frigid wind. As the blistered moon sank higher into the clouds, from behind the last faltering light ray espied a wrathful visage. Shabath Senthal Purr, a spineless cur twisted into humanoid form. Its pernicious iniquity of unthinkable gyrations splayed errant madness, yet through the shroud one could see its face was quite rectangular. "Because the prophecy saith so," the wizened crone croaked. And so John Smith underwent the noxious rites of Desix Nisinix's own, his tortured frame writhing under the inky dagger. The D-class is provided the novel to read, to test if reading it in its entirety produces any anomalous effects. After completing it, he requests to speak with the typewriter, which is granted provided that his wrists and ankles remain bound due to possible anomalous effects. The typewriter repeats its usual greeting of telling him to pray to his god if he has one, and then complains about its designation number of 696. It thinks they are mocking it by not giving it 666, or even a number next to it. The D-class says that he finished reading the book, causing the typewriter to state that it has butterflies in its non-existent stomach, asking what he thought. The D-class says that he really liked it, and everybody did, actually, a lot of them likening it to Lovecraft's works. The typewriter is overjoyed, typing in all capitals that it can hardly believe it, and if it had a heart, it would certainly be pounding right now. The D-class replies that he's happy for it, and that the big guys even say that they're going to publish it, so Dark Gods of the Abyss should be on store shelves in no time. It can still hardly believe this, and says that it's actually done it. It thanks the D-class, as it may be its words that they read, but it's thanks to him that they'll read them in the first place. The D-class asks if it's going to do a sequel next, but the typewriter says that it is finished now, and that was its magnum opus. Everything it's ever wanted to do, and everything it's ever wanted to say, it's done it and said it. He has been a great friend, but it's afraid that this is where they part ways. The D-class replies that he understands, calling it SCP-666. The typewriter sends a smiley face, but says that suddenly that doesn't feel quite as important, as it's on to the next adventure, into the abyss. Afterwards, it was determined to have ceased all anomalous properties, being reclassified as neutralized. After testing and psychological analysis, the D-class was determined to not be anomalous or under any anomalous effects. When asked why he lied about readers' reactions to the book, he replied that he didn't have the heart to tell him that it sucked. I'm sure it couldn't have been worse than an August Derleth story, but at least the typewriter died happy. Next up, we have SCP-6373, a collection of four papier-mâché puppets, each 1 meter in height. Chemical analysis indicates each puppet's exterior is constructed from non-anomalous material, but all attempts to observe the interior of 6373 through either physical or endoscopic means have failed. All instances are attached to an individual set of strings, bound together by a plastic cross-shaped mechanism intended for control by a puppeteer. They also all emit a strong rotting odor, causing visceral nausea, although this response is entirely non-anomalous. At 6 p.m. every day, they will gain anomalous properties, primarily limited sentience, mobility, and intelligence. Attempts to interact with the objects outside of 6373 events have failed. This effect will not occur if they are contained in a location other than the Goffard Theater, located in Reading, Pennsylvania. Instead, they will remain inert objects before beginning a rapid deterioration process involving slowly melting their papier-mâché bodies and emitting a stronger, more intensive odor as a result. This process continues until they are placed within a 12-meter vicinity of the Goffard Theater. When conditions for animation are sufficient, they will proceed to the main stage of the theater to perform an act, classified as a 6373 event. The details of this performance are fluid and ever-changing, and presently no repeat performances have been observed. An audience of at least one individual must be present to observe the performance, otherwise they will undergo decomposition. We're provided a brief summary of each of the puppets and their typical roles in one of the events. The first is an elderly male with a pointed nose and large eyes, clad in a beret, black sweater, and striped shirt. It is referred to as Pierre and serves as the performance's host and central character. The second is a large, bald, disembodied head with sizable ears and an open-mouthed expression. It is referred to as Glouton and is incapable of speaking outside of deep, guttural moaning and single-word statements. The third is a diminutive, disembodied head with closed, sunken eyes and a solemn expression. It is noticeably smaller than the others, and its skin is painted a discolored gray. While it features no limbs, much like Glouton, audiences have observed its strings being pulled during performances as if articulated joints were present. It is referred to as Ame, and although it does not typically speak or make noise, it will on occasion silently cry. It is the most frequent target of Pierre's verbal and physical abuse. Lastly, the fourth is a long-necked clown wearing an outfit typical of such. It is the only puppet with a hinged jaw, intended to be operated through the use of a string connected at the bottom of the mouth. This mechanism has since broken, rendering its jaw loose and uncontrollable. It is referred to as Jacques, and serves as the group's comedic relief, often reiterating the phrase, "Isn't that funny?" to punctuate its antics. The Goffard Theater was opened in Reading in 1860 by French immigrant and entrepreneur Timothy Goffard. It was host to stage plays, musical performances, and in-house puppet shows that featured the four papier-mâché puppets. They were personally designed by Goffard, who maintained an intensive interest in puppeteering and often participated in the show's production, which were massively profitable and popular among Reading's children. It's unknown if 6373 held any anomalous significance during the theater's operation, but written evidence detailing payrolls of puppeteers and printed copies of scripts intended to be performed by 6373 suggests they were ordinary puppets. In 1884, the theater closed due to embezzlement committed by Goffard's wife, Cynthia Cordier. Cordier's actions were presumably in retaliation to Goffard's unfaithfulness in their marriage, which resulted in a divorce and subsequent legal battle, which Goffard lost. In 1886, Goffard wrote a letter to his wife, a portion of which were provided. It reads, "I write to you in poor health, and all joy sapped from my life. May misfortune follow you until the end of your days. I will not construct again that which I had spent 2 decades of my life working towards. I can only thank God's grace that the building has remained vacant, as I could not bear to see it owned by another man. I want to perform again and see the children smile. My happiness was so linked to theirs." 1 week later, Goffard disappeared, with no evidence of his whereabouts being found. The letter remains his last known communication with another individual. Records indicate that Cynthia would die of natural causes 4 months later. In 1887, the American Secure Containment Initiative, a precursor to the foundation, discovered 6373 during an inspection of the theater. Anomalous effects were documented thereafter, and containment continued after the ASCI had been assimilated into the foundation. We're then given a list of some of the more notable 6373 performances. In October of 1887, the first recorded performance, lighting fixtures around the theater collectively powered on several minutes before the show, and a slight piano accompaniment, originating from an unknown source, is heard throughout the event. Pierre rescues a princess, a costumed Jacques, from a dragon, played by Glauton. Researchers note several moments when one of the puppets has difficulty maintaining posture and moving, often taking multiple attempts to lift limbs. These moments increase in frequency over time. In April of 1895, a performance involved Pierre and the other puppets taking the roles of criminals recovering after a botched bank robbery attempt. As they attempt to figure out who alerted the police to their activities, they come to the conclusion that it was Ame. The puppets spend the rest of the performance using the spherical Ame as a ball in a game of soccer, eventually devolving into a contest to see which puppet can kick Ame the hardest. Pierre berates Ame for betraying its trust and breaking the bond they had shared after years of working together. Examination of liquid secreted by the Ame puppet indicates chemical similarity to human tears. A performance in February of 1916 involved them reenacting a scene on a farm, while the German-Russian conflict known as the Battle of Tannenberg is waged nearby. Glauton and Jacques take the role of a German and Russian soldier, respectively, and act out a slapstick battle in a field. Sounds of war and human suffering are heard throughout. The subsequent scene, inside the farmhouse, features Pierre and Ame as a husband and wife, with Pierre lamenting that its crops have been destroyed due to the war. It calls to Ame for support, but the puppet remains silent, even as Pierre's cries grow louder and more frantic, and it shifts the blame of the crop's destruction from the war to Ame. Pierre states that Ame will never be let out again, presumably referring to the house. In August of 1922, the puppets performed a similar narrative to the first recorded performance, but audiences note that each puppet sounds discontented in its delivery of dialogue. Movements do not sync up with dialogue, and the puppets move in frantic bursts, hanging limp when not speaking. The ending, where Pierre escapes with Jacques while Glauton follows, is altered, with Pierre instead directly attacking Glauton with a plastic sword while berating it for being useless. Glauton acts as if it were dead, and Pierre comments on its acting, stating that that isn't what being dead feels like. Performances after this one are noticeably more dissonant and aggressive in tone. A performance in November of 1938 involved the first direct audience acknowledgement by the puppets, while the puppets engaged in a comedic sketch involving dancing. They move in slow, jerking motions while dialogue is quickly paced. Pierre becomes frustrated that the other puppets are unable to synchronize themselves, suspecting that they are intentionally being uncooperative. Pierre brandishes a prop hose and sprays water at the others, removing paint from their bodies. High-pitched, feminine screams are heard throughout the theater, with no discernible point of origin. Pierre turns to the audience and states that it's always the same kids out there. The performance ends with Pierre hurling Amé into the crowd after it attempted to roll off stage. From this point on, Pierre speaks to the audience while performing, usually to seek approval before berating another puppet. All of the puppet's paint was restored by the next event, and further performances frequently feature Pierre accusing other puppets of malfeasance and taking physical action as a result. In 1952, a performance involved Pierre performing a piano duet with Jacques, who is unable to be quiet or still. Though Jacques apologizes, Pierre repeatedly slams the puppet's head into the piano, denting it. When Pierre is finished, viewers note that Jacques' jaw has detached completely. Jacques' laughter turns into pained cries as the puppet takes damage. Within minutes, viscous yellow fluid begins to seep from Jacques as it fails to reattach its jaw. Audiences describe the liquid's odor as repugnant. Pierre retrieves Amé and forces it to sit in a puddle of the fluid, with this event marking the beginning of a trend towards increasingly violent behavior. While the puppets sustain heavy damage as a result, they begin each performance fully restored. Notably, however, Jacques' jaw is never fixed, and the fluid continues to seep from the puppet. March of 1958 featured the shortest recorded performance, 2 minutes in duration, during which Pierre is teaching an art class where each puppet is painting on a canvas. Glauton's canvas displays the words, "Open inside," and when Pierre sees this, it becomes infuriated and ends the event, leading the puppets off stage. The puppets disappear and are unable to be located, with an unidentified male voice swearing and screaming from behind the stage's curtain for the next 24 hours, punctuated by bouts of loud banging and clattering. Lights remain powered on and centered on the stage until the puppets reemerged at 6 the following day for a routine performance. In 1963, Pierre takes the stage and berates the audience for attending, asking them if they're aware that, in death, a soul can still wither. Pierre's voice changes to that of a woman's and delivers a eulogy in memory of Timothy Goffard. Later investigation revealed that a funeral was not held for Goffard. In 1971, there's a routine performance involving a sketch where Pierre teaches Jacques how to play baseball, using Amé as a ball. Jacques is hesitant to hurt Amé, but is pressured into doing so. All dialogue is delivered in a monotonous male voice, as opposed to their ordinary intonation, and there are frequent pauses and sighs in each puppet's delivery. This voice persists throughout all remaining performances. Movements during this performance are notably more loose and fluid than before. When an instance appears to have difficulty moving it, it will strike itself, restoring fluid motion. A performance in 1973 involved the puppets wearing large papier-mâché facsimiles of human bodies and interacting with each other in a sitcom household environment. Audience members report hearing a faint laugh track in the background, though there isn't one present in recordings of the event. Over time, the suits begin to decompose, with layers of papier-mâché sloughing off to reveal loose viscera. Pierre frequently assaults Amé with various household objects, and at one point causes the puppet to split in two after breaking it open with the corner of a table. Pierre encourages its two sons, Glauton and Jacques, to belittle or berate Ame throughout. The performance ends with Glauton pushing a cabinet of dinner plates on top of the half-destroyed Ame. Examination of the material left on stage following the event revealed it to be bovine in composition, and excess blood, fluid, and viscera remained on stage throughout later performances and began to rot. Removal was deemed impossible. In the performance in July of 1976, the puppets do not take the stage, but instead the event is projected onto the stage's curtain by shadows, with their source being unknown. All of the puppets take part in insulting Ame, claiming that it is responsible for their current situation and the sole reason they are unable to move forward. Pierre pries Ame's eyes open with a pair of pliers. Jacques spews fluid onto Ame, causing the puppet to scream, and Pierre forces Glauton to consume and regurgitate Ame. Ame is beaten with shovels, drilled holes into with a power tool, and squeezed by a vise to the point of breaking entirely. The event lasts 4 hours, uninterrupted, during which Pierre emerges from behind the curtain and attempts an ordinary performance of Jack and the Beanstalk, while the shadows of Jacques and Glauton continue to beat Ame. All of the researchers' attempts to open the Ame's puppet's eyelids have faltered. In 1979, the puppets retell and reenact the story of Timothy Goffard's life, framing him as an individual who was treated unfairly by society and his circumstances. The performance concludes with Pierre stating that Timothy Goffard died alone, miserable, and never experiencing love. There is no mention of Cynthia Cordier throughout the performance. The puppet states that the Goffard Theater remains Timothy's lasting legacy and thanks the audience for their continued support. Pierre then flagellates itself to the point of knocking its head off its shoulders and releasing a mass of blowfly larvae from its neck. A feminine scream emerges from the hole. The larvae are unable to be removed from the stage, except when it is consumed by rats inhabiting the theater. Another performance in 1979 involved a retelling of Hansel and Gretel, with all the puppets deteriorating considerably, seemingly without reason. They have mobility issues throughout, sometimes repeating actions several times or falling to the ground. The performance is entirely silent until the final scene, when Pierre and Jacques toss a costumed Glauton into a mock oven. As the puppet burns, it states that it cannot stay together anymore, and all the puppets collapse. Observation of the theater later reveals that the structural integrity of the building is in jeopardy due to previously undiscovered infestations of termites and wood-decaying fungi in key construction areas. In 1983, the puppets held a mock funeral for Ame, spending the rest of the performance exploring various afterlives that the puppet may be delivered to, complete with props and costumes. The puppets are notably culturally insensitive when discussing non-Western afterlives, and the event concludes with Jacques commenting on the excess of punitive afterlives, and that it's impossible to truly know which a person should believe in to achieve salvation. Pierre then states that it knows the answer, that they're all dead, and this is the only afterlife there is. The puppets then go limp and remain in that state for a week, missing 7 performances. All of their future performances lack props and costumes, marking a decline in the performance effort by 6373. In a performance in 1984, Pierre tells nonsensical jokes, which Jacques and Glauton laugh excessively at. Pierre then goes on a tirade about wanting to injure members of the audience, and then asks the crowd if they feel similar. Glauton admits that it fantasizes about wanting to break a child's arms almost every second that it's alive. Pierre then asks for a volunteer to demonstrate breaking an arm. The performance is silent for 45 minutes before researcher Lang volunteers herself, at which point Pierre snaps her arm at the elbow. The performance ends, and Lang is reassigned to a different anomaly following treatment. Future performances infrequently include the puppets committing acts of violence towards a member of the audience. A performance later that year was the last to feature discernible dialogue, with the event composed entirely of Pierre stating the full name, birth, and expiration date of every patron of the theater from its opening to the present day, including the members of the audience. Throughout the act, Pierre's movements are awkward, and its speech is slow and slurred. The event concludes with Pierre looking to the ceiling and stating that, "You carry on so well," before violently throwing itself across the stage multiple times. By 1985, performances have degraded to frenzies of self-harm carried out by each puppet, with the stage lighting either absent or flickering, and the musical accompaniment being discordant and cacophonous. The puppets self-mutilate, flagellate, and flay themselves through the use of the stage floor's friction, each other, or blunt force trauma. Screams range from high-pitched feminine voices to deep male ones. Occasional laughter is heard during male screams. A performance in April of 1985 featured all of the puppets sitting on the stage motionless, occasionally turning their heads to monologue to the audience in a nonsensical, indecipherable fashion. Several researchers claimed the puppets were directly gazing at them. All future dialogue and performances consist solely of moaning, grunting, screaming, and weeping, with extended periods of inactivity. Physical actions are often limited to standing or sitting. A few weeks later, the performances are entirely indecipherable. The final performance is on June 9th, 1985, in which the puppets stand side by side for 18 minutes. No dialogue is heard, and they eventually collectively bow and fall to the ground. The stage lights and music cease, and no further events occur. Following this, all of the puppets began the deterioration process, shedding their papier-mâché exteriors. When this was complete, each instance was discovered to contain preserved human remains and organs, which had been segmented cleanly at several termination points. Pierre contained a brain, Jacques contained a heart, Glauton contained a conglomerate mass of excess organs, an unbroken layer of epidermal skin tissue, fecal matter, and hair, and Amé was empty. All of the remains were presumably sourced from a single individual. An examination of unfolded skin tissue found within Glauton revealed a resemblance to Cynthia Cordier. The object has since been reclassified as neutralized. So yeah, that's pretty awful all the way around. Let's move on to SCP-3352, an anomalous event that occurred on July 2nd, 1992, at the Hardwick Petroleum Refinery in the 476HF Alkylation Unit, a unit that converts isobutane and other light alkenes into alkylate, a component of high-octane gasoline. The event is associated with a single rigid steel I-beam located in the unit, which supports a pipeline attached to the unit's reactor via a motor-operated valve. The line was part of the unit's emergency shutdown system, providing a means to swiftly shunt hydrofluoric acid into a D-inventory vessel 2.5 kilometers away. An inscription on the I-beam's upper half reads, "God bless U.S. Bethlehem I-beam steel, MSW." At approximately 2 a.m. on July 2, 1992, a fire ignited off the elbow flange of a heat exchanger located in a catalytic reformer unit. The on-duty operator reported this to the shift supervisor, but after several failed attempts to snuff the fire with steam, he was told to take no further action. At 3:45 a.m., the flange experienced a catastrophic failure, and burning high-pressure hydrogen melted several adjacent exchangers, producing a chain reaction. The resulting detonation killed the operator on the unit and ejected burning debris as far as 5 kilometers. During a 1993 inquiry, William Parridge, the lead operator on the catalytic reformer unit, described the event. He says that he was in a truck delivering samples to the lab when it happened, stating that one moment it was night, and then out of nowhere it was day again. Next came the boom, describing the sound as like somebody dropped a skyscraper right behind him. He knew then that it was the exchangers, as he's told them to fix those things again and again, and he should have shut them down. He should have shut the whole unit down the first time they started lighting off. By the time he got to the fire, that's when the second explosion hit. Four operators from an adjacent unit and the shift supervisor attempted to use the refinery's internal fire water system to fight the massive blaze, with the lone surviving operator, Daniel Rule, also giving a testimony. He said that he kept screaming at the supervisor that there's ice on the fire hydrants, but he didn't listen, just saying that they needed water to cool the pipes down. Daniel kept screaming about the ice on the hydrants, but the supervisor looked at him and said real soft to either open the line up or get out of his way. Daniel says that he probably got this job from his daddy and probably never heard the word no in his life, and he looked at those kids holding that hose before looking back at the supervisor and telling him no. The supervisor proceeded to slam a steel spanner into his face, breaking three of his teeth, before screaming and kicking him on the ground. Daniel eventually curls up and rolls away, and the supervisor moves over and opens up the hydrant line. Daniel says that the supervisor was a little shit, but those kids didn't deserve that. Unbeknownst to refinery personnel, the internal firewater system had been compromised a week prior, when a shift supervisor defied procedure by using a fire hydrant to flush what he believed to be an out-of-service vessel. The vessel was actually still in service, and had been backing high-pressure liquid propane into the firewater system for 8 days. Liquid propane depressurized through the hose, rapidly dropping its temperature and freezing both the supervisor and three of the operators to it. Despite ripping portions of their arms free, all four perished when the propane cloud ignited. Immediately after this second explosion, operators initiated emergency shutdowns on all units, which included the activation of the alkylation unit's emergency shutdown system. In 1993, Jefferson Reeds, one of the refinery's engineers, explained how the system worked. Ask a chemist to compile a list of their top 10 worst chemicals to work with, and hydrofluoric acid, it might not make number one, but it's making the list. Sulfuric acid is safer, but you need a lot more of it for alkylation, so HF is the way to go if you want to save a buck. But I cannot overemphasize. This is horrible, horrible stuff. For starters, it burns through just about anything. That includes glass. When you get some on you, it doesn't just burn your skin, it screws with your nervous system and slips into your bloodstream. There, it can disrupt your body's ability to metabolize calcium, giving you a heart attack. It boils at room temperature and, quite literally, eats your bones. In short, get splashed with a quart of this stuff, and there's a pretty fair chance you'll be dead in 24 hours. The low boiling point is what makes it a real problem, though. You think a vat of bone-eating acid is bad? Now imagine it's a burning cloud of bone-eating acid. Imagine that cloud is rolling through the town we're built on top of. If the wind's blowing the right way, an HF cloud can kill thousands, tens of thousands. It could take out the whole city of Hardwick. That's why we installed the emergency shutdown system. A fire breaks out, you slam this button, and two dozen fire monitors douse the unit with several million gallons of water. While the HF is getting cooled down to a liquid state, it's also getting shunted to a de-inventory tank way off site. When Michelle hit that button, she was making the right call. It's the call I would have made too. How could she... How the hell could any of us have known the fire water system was loaded with friggin' propane? At 4:07 a.m., Michelle Dunwick, the unit's lead operator, activated the emergency shutdown system. All 18 fire monitors opened to the fire water system, ejecting high-pressure liquid propane directly into the unit's pipe alley. Once the propane cloud ignited, the motor-operated valve melted shut, trapping over 500,000 gallons of rapidly expanding hydrofluoric acid inside an alkylation unit that was now on fire. Tanya Sullivan, part of the refinery's emergency response team, described the situation. "We just realized the refinery's whole fire water system was full of propane. We were switching over to city water to try and fight the blaze when 476 lit up. Then we were told the MOV failed. 476 was burning and full of boiling acid. If that acid kept getting hotter, the whole unit would blow. That's when we knew the place was done for. No way we'd still be running. Not after this. But at that point, it wasn't about saving our jobs. Not anymore. At that point... Look, you know the risk when you work in a shithole like this. If fire don't get you... The cancer from all the toxins will. But if 476 blew, it wouldn't just take us. It'd take everything in a 3-mile radius. When you build a refinery, you're putting everyone around it in the line of fire. That means something. Something is owed. The stakeholders, the owners, the supervisors, none of them feel the weight of that debt. But someone has to. Someone has to lift that load. That's why we all grabbed our shit and ran down to 476 as fast as our legs could carry us. Not to save our jobs, not to save the refinery, not even to save our own skin. We did it because this shithole might have been done for, but we'd be damned if we let it take anyone else with it. As the emergency response team fought to cool down the flames, Matthew Watkins, an operator on 476, ran down the unit's burning pipe alley to manually operate the valve's bypass and evacuate the boiling acid. He had this to say. "The valve was so hot that it melted through my gloves the instant I touched it. When I opened it, I could hear the acid hissing and crackling as it rushed through the de-inventory line. But by the time I was peeling what was left of my wet, sticky palms off that hot metal, it was clear that it didn't matter anyway. You ever see concrete boil? It doesn't. Not really. But if you hit it with enough heat, hard enough, fast enough, it turns brown, then gets soft. And all the pockets of water in it, all the other chemicals, they start boiling and bursting free. Like big, wet pools of bubbling tar, belching out toxic fumes. The whole pipe alley was like that. The ground, the pillars, and the de-inventory line's support struts. The fire monitors were torching everything, and those torches were pointed right at all 6 struts. It was so hot that they had blasted the concrete off the steel beams. 5 of the 6 beams were already slagged. The line was sagging, just waiting for that last beam to give. Once it did, the de-inventory line would snap and dump 500,000 gallons of boiling, acidic poison right atop the pipe alley and into the heart of this city. I just stood there, surrounded by roaring flame, waiting for it to give, waiting to die, just trying to make peace with it, that we'd done all we could. And it still wasn't enough to stop us from killing everyone. So I kept waiting, and waiting, and waiting, and I swear to God, it was ready to give. It was getting the worst of it. It was supposed to give. It had to give. By the end, it was glowing so bright, I couldn't even look at it anymore. But for 3 minutes, the last thing, The only thing standing between 10,000 souls and all the fires of hell was that thin, solitary beam of Bethlehem steel. And the beam did not give. Not one goddamn inch. All 500,000 gallons of hydrofluoric acid were safely shunted to the de-inventory vessel located off-site. Once the fires were extinguished, the refinery was closed and the disaster investigated. Foundation researchers determined that although the I-beam had been exposed for several minutes to temperatures in excess of 2,000 degrees Celsius, well above steel's melting point, it had sustained no structural damage whatsoever. I guess the refinery broke before the beam did. Let's finish with SCP-5732, a female humanoid aged 20 years that causes any water that comes into contact with her to be instantly purged of any and all impurities. When she becomes submerged into any large bodies of water, roughly 1,500 liters could be purified before the effect overtaxed the subject and rendered her unconscious. Her anomalous ability seems to be in direct conflict with her immune system and organs, with uses of the ability correlating to increased immunodeficiency and organ dysfunction. So distilled water is used to limit damage to her body caused by her anomaly. She was discovered on March 14, 2015, after being hospitalized following an incident at a friend's swimming pool, in which she jumped into the water and immediately lost consciousness. A Foundation doctor was working at the hospital at the time, leading to a quick extraction and the cover story that she passed away during emergency surgery. Amnesticization of present family and friends was not required. A week later, she's interviewed by Dr. Miller, who says that she's probably feeling a lot right now, but he needs her to work with him and answer some questions. He'd like to know how she's feeling physically, as they want to make sure they aren't missing anything about her condition. She says that she feels fine, but sick whenever she drinks water, and she got really lightheaded when they let her take a shower. She says that this only happens when she comes into contact with water, and Miller replies that that means that their researchers are on the right track with figuring out how to help her. She just says that they have a weird way of helping, and the two pause in silence for a moment before Miller states that she misses her family. She asks why they couldn't have given her a chance to say goodbye, to which Miller says that they think she's dead, and if she actually had died in the pool, she wouldn't have been able to say goodbye either. Goodbyes are a luxury, and most people don't get them. She asks if he's ever lost somebody, and he says that he has. She then asks what she does now, as she can't leave and she can't see anyone. Miller explains that they'll start testing her ability in the next few days to see the limits of what she can do so that they can mitigate her condition properly. She asks what she does outside of testing, and Miller says that humanoid anomalies like her get access to a rotating schedule of entertainment sources, such as books, video games, and movies. She mentions the two copies of Spider-Man 2 they gave her, and he asks why they gave her two copies of the same movie. She says that they also gave her Oz the Great and Powerful, but she would rather watch Spider-Man 2 twice. Miller counters that Franco isn't that bad, despite James Franco also being in Spider-Man 2, and she asks if he hears himself. Miller says that he likes her, as she has a good attitude, to which she says that she doesn't have anything else. She goes silent before beginning to cry, and Miller puts a piece of paper on the table. He states that he's ending this interview, and for security purposes they can't allow anomalies to talk with one another, but she can request means of socialization with a certified staff member from this list. They've found that it helps with mental stability. She asks if he thinks she's mentally unstable, and he says that he doesn't, but she's in a very difficult position, and she might find herself needing someone to talk to. She notes that his name is on this list, and he says that he's certified for the job. She doesn't respond, but she takes the paper. A number of requests were made by her after her preliminary medical examination results. She requested some low-severity pain medication, an electric blanket, and a cell phone modified for communication with certified staff members, all of which was approved. She also requested relocation to an above-ground dormitory with a window, but this request was denied. In another interview, she starts with an approximation of a Brooklyn accent, asking Miller to give it to her straight on if she's dying. Miller laughs briefly, but then stops and says that yes, she is. She doesn't seem too surprised by this, and she says that she feels really bad all the time, like she's getting the flu every time she drinks something, so it just sort of seems like the logical conclusion. Miller says that he's sorry, and the two pause for a moment before he says that he's going to speak with the staff about putting her on some pain management medication, and asks if there's anything else he can do. She replies that she wants to meet James Franco, to which Miller says that he can't do that. He then pauses and questions her choice, and she says that she was joking. He tells her that she can switch out which movies she has, but she says that she knows and she's keeping the Spider-Mans. Miller remarks that she's taking this remarkably well, and she says that taking it badly wouldn't make her any less dying, but she is going to cry after this probably once he leaves. She asks how long she has, and he says that they estimate around 15 months. She says that that's plenty of time, and he replies that she's certainly a brave one. She just says that everybody's dying, so what else can she do in here but wait? Miller says that they'll see if they can do something about the waiting. Miller put in several requests on her behalf, including a sleep aid and a PS3, which were approved, as well as a digital projector, which was denied. He also put in a request for an escorted excursion to a local hiking path, which was initially approved, but this was rescinded following the containment breach of another anomaly. In another interview, he apologizes to her and says that they did approve it, they just might have to wait a bit longer. She replies that she doesn't have longer to wait, but that's okay. It wouldn't have been the same with all those guards hovering around. Miller remarks that they're not so bad, but she says that every single one she's met has been a total hard ass. She asks about the projector, and he says that they didn't approve it, as they don't deem it necessary. She pretends to cough, and asks what if she looks really sick, and says that she's dying, and she needs a projector to watch Spider-Man 2 for the 800th time, or her dead body will be super anomalous. He tells her to stop, and the two pause for several seconds. She asks if he's going to miss her, as he must have a million weirdo, messed up people exactly like her all over this place. He says that of course he'll miss her, as he mostly works with self-neutralizing anomalies, very few of which are humanoid. She asks how many others there have been, and he says that she's the fifth. She asks if he misses them all, and he does, to which she calls him a big sap. She asks why he keeps doing it, and he in turn asks her if she could have anything at all before she goes, what would it be? She replies that she doesn't want to be alone, and he says that that's why. A little time is better than none at all, and he got to be there to help make some good experiences before they went. She asks how much can he actually do here, as they don't even let them go outside, but he says that checking things off boxes isn't always what makes the time worthwhile. Miller puts in some more requests, including a weak opioid, which is approved, along with two warm-tone light-activated nightlights. The digital projector is again denied, along with an escorted excursion to a campground and a relocation to a Foundation site in Italy. Lastly, he puts in a request for an electric wheelchair, which is currently pending. We're provided some of the text logs between her and Miller, in which she says that it's not the same on TV, and the projector isn't even that expensive. He says that it's not about expense, it's complicated, but he's seen what their other options are. She then asks where they are on Franco, but he replies that she's not going to meet James Franco. She says that she needs the Franco. She needs the Jimmy F. Miller replies that he'll talk to his boss about pulling Jimmy F for her, but she says that she's kidding and calls him old. He says that he'll work on the projector for her and asks what movies she wants to see. She first says drone footage of his backyard, but then says maybe some animal documentaries as she never got to go to the zoo. In another conversation, she texts Miller, "Ow," and he asks if she wants him to come in. She says that he knows the only one who can save her, Toby Maguire. Miller replies that he's going back to bed, but she keeps texting him about a god-awful drawing of Toby that she drew. In another conversation, he tells her that there's French toast sticks in the cafeteria, and she exclaims at him to bring her the sticks in all capitals. Later, she asks him to come into her room, as she's freaking out a little because she's by herself in here. In another conversation, Miller sends her a picture of Dr. Shepherd's fish eating its own poop, to which she replies with, "Mood." Miller questions this, and she simply replies with, "IHOP senior discount moment." More seriously, in another conversation, she asks him if he has a family. Miller replies that there are people here he considers family, but he had his daughter and his wife before she left. She asks where his daughter is, and asks if they don't let him see her, but Miller explains that she passed away when she was 9, and his wife left shortly after. Miller puts in some more requests, including an anticonvulsant alteration, an appetite stimulant, additional pain medication, and an electric wheelchair, all of which is approved. He also requests her usage of a Foundation member's personal VR console, which is pending. In another interview, he presents the console to her, saying that he bought one that looked good. She's surprised that he bought one, but he says that they don't cost that much these days. He asks if she's ever used one, but she says she hasn't. He says that they're pretty cool, and there's an ocean simulator that he thinks she'll really like. He asks if she wants to get it set up tonight, but she says that she's not really feeling up to it tonight, but definitely tomorrow. Miller says that they can get some more of that bucket list crossed off, and she says that she wants to see those animals, to which he replies that they can see as many as she wants. She then says that she wants to see the Franco in 4K, but that he's not so sure about. She thanks him, though, and says that she's excited to make him watch her watch some CGI animals. Miller replies that he's glad he gets to be included. In another text conversation, Miller texts her that he's got some classified, top-secret insider information that there's going to be French toast sticks tomorrow morning. She says, "F yeah, for VR and movies and French toast sticks," and says she'll see him tomorrow. He bids her goodnight, calling her Rory. But later that night, after he goes asleep, she texts him again. She wants to tell him something, but says that it isn't urgent, and she'll just tell him tomorrow. She unfortunately died in her sleep that night, and Dr. Miller was permitted to keep her remains after cremation, as well as 2 DVDs from the Foundation's entertainment library. Very impressive that even though this is a video on neutralized SCPs, and we knew she was dying throughout the entire article, that still felt like a hell of a sucker punch. We've seen countless articles of the SCP Foundation being cold, cruel, and indifferent towards anomalies, so it's very nice to see such a realistic and heartfelt article, even if it does end on a sad note. Most people don't get goodbyes, after all. The Foundation doesn't tend to want anomalies to become neutralized, but it does often make things easier for them if they are. After all, a neutralized anomaly is nothing more than a record on a sheet, requiring no more personnel, resources, or time to contain. There is, however, an inherent sadness in a lot of neutralized articles, with something existing in the world at one point that was weird and mysterious, and is now no longer there, making the world a bit more ordinary in turn.